Father, show me the best ways to have the most fun inspiring the largest number of people to naturally, easily experience vibrantly, exquisitely healthy, wealthy, passionate living in the shortest amount of time with the least intrusion into their lives so that we can enjoy a global loving community. Well, that's worth going for, and one of the things that is going to make it easier is to tune in today and listen to our wonderful, wonderful guest. We have a guest, Robert Church, who is going to just tantalize our taste buds today with goodness. He's going to help us learn to make our meals super yummy and powerfully healthy, too. And Chef Robert Church will share secrets revealed in his new book, get this, The Tao of Tofu. I mean, what's that about? And that's going to be sure to make you a big hit at mealtime. And Robert is a self-taught chef, and he specializes in spectacular multi-course dinners designed to immerse his students, all of the wonderful folks out there that are following along with his way of cooking, immerse them in the smells, flavors, and cooking techniques specific to different regions and countries, and exhaustive research and menu planning to maintain the true spirit of food is there while Robert keeps the execution of the dishes accessible to domestic kitchens. It means you don't have to go out and spend a ton of money of getting specialized equipment. Now, if you want to dress up for these meals, that's another matter. And, of course, presentation, complimentary flavors, variety, and sound nutritional values all combine to make each dinner truly a unique and palate-pleasing experience. Well, our wonderful guest today is going to share some amazing fun. And some people aren't sure, well, you know, this Oriental food, a lot of it doesn't have a lot of meat in it. What about that? Well, before I bring Robert on, I want to let you know that an upcoming guest on the program is going to be Dr. Milton Mills. And this medical doctor out of Washington, D.C., basically has done extensive research around the world and about disease conditions. And the essence of what he found was that the countries that have the most meat consumption, the most dairy consumption, those are the countries with the most disease. So maybe there's something to lightening up on certain of the things we eat. And, of course, guess what we have on today? We have Chef Robert to help us to do just that and have it be delicious. So without further ado, welcome, Chef Robert.
That's the finest introduction I've ever had, Ken. Thank you very much for having me on this afternoon.
You're welcome. Well, this is exciting. I mean, this Tao of Tofu, that name. I got to just get to a little bit of what does this mean?
Well, the Tao of Tofu basically for me described my path from a kid cooking with my grandma and my mom all the way to teaching cooking classes and then finally culminating in the cookbook, sort of the path of the way of tofu. I thought best described my personal journey from cooking lemon meringue pies with my grandma to teaching people how to make tofu dishes.
Wow. Now, from meeting you at a recent vegetarian event, I'm guessing that you might be a vegetarian, or as my friend Gary says, a veterinarian. And I'm just wondering, can you go into a little bit about that? Have you been pursuing that lifestyle for a while?
Oh, sure, for 22 years. I came from a very meat and potatoes-oriented small town in southern Colorado and grew up like most people eating, you know, meat and potatoes kind of food. Came to Denver in 1982. I think I was 24 years old. And I began to sort of hit all the ethnic restaurants in town, you know, Ethiopian places, Chinese places. Everybody had a vegetarian section on the menu, which I'd never seen before. I'd never heard of a vegetarian in my life. And I made some friends who were vegetarians, and they were much more sophisticated than I was, and they explained the lifestyle to me. And I began to research it. I read Diet for a Small Planet by Francis Morlepay. And realize that this is sort of a big deal. You know, it's not just the impact you have on your body, it's the impact on the planet as a whole. And I tried it out for 6 weeks and felt so much better than I had ever in my life physically. Much more energy, I felt lighter, you know, much more vibrant. And I have not gone back since.
Wow. Okay, so you opened a door basically on an experiment. Mm-hmm. And you found that it was a path for you to have more vitality, more, and feel better.
It fit me perfectly.
Ah.
Yeah.
Oh, well, this is important because most of us are looking to have more energy, looking to feel better, because there's so much stress and a lot of things going on for people. And so the stronger and healthier we are, the more resistant we are to stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, so you ended up doing this because you'd researched and you found some importance to it, and then you started feeling better.
I did. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ken.
So, and then how did you evolve from this into teaching and, you know, cooking classes and getting into all of this pursuit that you've been doing that has led to this Tao of Tofu?
Well, I used to live by a Wild Oats Market in Glendale, and they had a real nice kitchen there for the food demos. And when I was in shopping once, I saw a fellow giving a cooking class. I thought, well, you know, what a great idea. I cook at home all the time. Why not bring some of my cooking style over here and try it out? Kind of on a lark. And I composed 3 pasta recipes and took them in, and I started, I think, the week after teaching. And what became sort of a once-a-month fun thing to do became cooking for them half the time every month and then working the other half of the time at my day job.
Ah.
So it took off more than anybody thought it was going to, and I eventually wound up being the only cooking instructor for 3 of the Wild Oats markets here in the downtown area.
Wow. Here we are in Denver, Colorado, and one of the areas where people are taking a look at the quality of their food. It's not just California, and it's not just Denver. This is starting to spread out, isn't it?
Very much so. I was amazed at the broad range of people that came to the classes. You might think only a certain, you know, small segment of the population would be interested in this food, and that's not true anymore, especially with the growing awareness of what's in processed food and things like that. People are taking a much bigger interest in their personal health, and also there's an ethical component to it as well. And I was just amazed and gratified at all the people I've met here in town and just the broad spectrum of the population that would come to these classes.
Huh. Now, you started, you said, I guess with some was it pasta or?
Three pasta recipes. It was a disaster. I wasn't really prepared. I'd never taught a cooking class in my life. In fact, I'd never taken a cooking class in my life. And I was surprised anybody came back the next time.
Oh.
But I developed a style. I use a mise en place style. Everything's ready to go. Things measured out. I do very little chopping in front of the students, very little measuring, and was able to throw together a three-course or four-course meal in an hour and a half for the students in the demo kitchen at Wild Oats.
Ah, okay. Now, they have high ceilings. Were you able to throw the pasta up to see if it was done?
No, but there was a back wall at the Glendale Market that I did throw it at, and it did stick, so we knew it was ready to eat.
Okay. I remember when I first heard about how to test the pasta to see if it was done.
That's true.
I thought that must have been created by some of the people that played in Animal House for a food fight.
Well, you have these pasta stalactites hanging from your ceiling all over the place in your kitchen afterwards, too.
Yeah.
That's half the fun.
Oh, mercy. Now, help a little bit here, because a number of people have kind of heard of tofu, but they may not be familiar with its background and maybe some of the food value, and then there's even some things to address about different forms of soy. So can you help us there?
Sure. Well, tofu is basically ground up cooked soybeans. They take dried beans, they rehydrate them, they cook them up, grind them up, and you get two components. And it's like cheese, a curd and a whey. The whey is soy milk, and the curd is what's called okara. And you may have seen okara at the Japanese markets fresh from the tofu factory. You can also find okara patties in I think they're pre-cooked box frozen okara patties, usually at like Wild Oats or Whole Foods. After that, the soy milk is taken, heated up, a coagulant is introduced, typically gypsum or I think magnesium chloride is used, and that creates tofu curds. So you drain the curds out from the rest of the whey, and then you put them in a press, and you press them, and the amount of time that you press them determines the consistency, and there's about four or five distinct consistencies that you get. You get silken soft, firm extra firm, and there's one that I included called yaki, which is Japanese grilled tofu, and that has a little more of a firm consistency and some nice grill marks on the outside. So that's basically tofu, very simple food. It's been around for, I think, thousands of years, a couple of thousand years. I can actually reference the first time it was mentioned in literature was at least 1,000 years ago, if not more, in China. And has become a staple, you know, throughout Asia. And even unknowingly here in America, you know, school kids get a lot of soy-fortified burgers and things like that. You don't even know you're getting it half the time. So you can find okara, tofu. You can find soy milk, which is very popular nowadays. Those are probably the main three that we're going to see. And okara is a bit rare, but I would suggest trying those okara patties sometime. They're delicious.
Oh, okay. And so this we would be, and I don't know when you separate it like that, I don't know if there's a difference in the nutrient value compared to, you know, the okara and the regular tofu. Or...
And I have to preface, I am not a nutritionalist and don't know a great deal about that kind of thing. I do know some things about it. You know, okara still has a good nutrient value. It's eaten a lot for its texture as well. It's got a fairly meaty texture to it. So the primary protein components and so forth go with the soy milk and wind up in the actual tofu that you buy in the store.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this would be a way, because sometimes, for instance, for me, growing up and loving, we would have a brisket sometimes,
and then
after the meal that we'd have that, it would be slicing it and heating it in barbecue sauce and having these barbecue brisket sandwiches.
Mm-hmm.
With a wonderful dill pickle. Excuse me, I've got my mouth is watering now.
I am too.
and so when I decided to experiment with a vegetarian lifestyle, that was one of the big cravings that was like so hard to overcome, and ended up with some of the tofu, essentially lightly searing it, to make it a little more firm, and then simmering it in a barbecue sauce. And that was one of the ways that I got started to satisfy some of that craving for the barbecue flavor.
I've done that as well. Grilled several pounds of tofu last summer here at the house. It was almost every other day.
Okay.
A little barbecue sauce on it, throw it on the grill, and just have some vegetables along with it or a salad, and it's a perfect dinner.
Okay. So do you find that's a good way, or what other ways would you suggest for people that are new to having this, and they've come from a meat and potatoes background? How can we make it easy to ease into some of this?
You know, grilling is an excellent way to do it, and you can also grill like portobello mushrooms along with it, things like that, and get a lovely grill flavor. Be sure and put some nice sauce on it. You can use a barbecue sauce. You could even use a Japanese eel sauce, which is eel-free. There's no eel in it, but it's designed for when they grill eel in Japan. It's got a lovely sort of a sweet, milder barbecue flavor to it. You can use a hoisin sauce as well. As you mentioned, pan frying, that's one of my main ways of preparing tofu, especially in the book. And that's one of the best ways to give it a little firmer texture, give it sort of a crispy coating on the outside. It's much more pleasing to our Western palate if there's some substantiality to it. One of the worst things that I encountered when I began to explore different cuisines is extra soft or soft tofu or silken tofu. In a sauce at a Chinese restaurant, it's sort of like a flan with a hot sauce over it, and I was really put off by that. And I think a lot of people get the same experience. They get a real soft, weird, custardy kind of dish with a brown sauce on it. You know, what's all that about? I don't want to even eat this here. I'm not going to prepare it at home. So if you do it right when you begin the dish, if you give it some texture and give it some tooth, then the outcome will be so much more pleasing to our palates and more substantial. And I think that will get people to enjoy tofu a lot more if it's prepared properly.
Okay. And so this is part of one of the reasons to, if we go visit your website at chefrobertchurch.com, is that right?
That's correct.
Go there. We can not only see your smiling face, there's an opportunity to either get the soft cover version of your book, or I noticed we could just download it.
You can get a PDF version as well, an e-book, I think it's called.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a quick way to don't have to leave the comfort of your home.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the bookstores haven't started delivery service, so.
No, probably never will.
So this way, you can just start cooking that tonight.
Absolutely.
Now, let's see. What would you suggest as we start to get into some of the areas of your book, as some of this how to get started?
If you were going to just cook your first tofu dish ever, and I actually had that question asked of me a couple of times at the convention last Saturday. I recommended it's a Thai dish. It's Thai tofu. I think it's Thai chili tofu. The reason I recommend that is it's very easy to make. There's not a lot of exotic ingredients. And it's got a great balance of flavors. It has sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and also a little bit of heat as well. The sauce cooks down, coats the tofu beautifully, almost sort of like this ebony-colored brown, and has a very nice texture to it. It's perfect over rice, and I just thought with the ease of it, the fact that it's different than the things you'll find typically in the Chinese restaurants, so forth like that, would be a great way to introduce people, pardon me, to tofu. Something really good, knockout flavor, but not hard to do.
Okay. Now, is that the tofu in Thai sweet glaze?
That is a version of it. There's also a Thai chili tofu, and I can actually look. I've got the book right in front of me.
Oh.
And I can look right where it is here.
Okay.
Let's see here. It's on page 120.
Oh, boy. Okay. And now you have, I guess, on your website, you have also listed a recipe.
I do one a month. I'll have sort of the recipe of the month. And I will put this one up, if you'd like, for this month. so the listeners might look at it as well since we've talked about it.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, especially since you speak of it as something that's a great way to get introduced to this, and you've got this combination of flavors that could please, I guess, a number of different palates.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, ooh, doesn't that sound good?
Well, I will do that. Yeah, it honestly is. After making it once, and I got to eat some of the leftovers sometimes at the classes, I was just knocked out by it. I love the recipe.
And most of these, are all these ingredients easy to get at most grocery stores?
You can find these anywhere, even King Super, Safeway, what have you. And also, you know, King's and Safeway are pretty good about carrying extra firm tofu. You can typically find it back in the produce section. It's always refrigerated, of course, to keep it fresh. And in Denver, at least, you'll find Denver Tofu Company, which is, for my money, the best you can get. And I based all my recipes on the classes I did using that particular tofu. It's very good stuff.
Okay.
As far as the texture goes, it's just absolutely perfect. And the nice thing about this chili tofu is it demonstrates the preferred way of doing the tofu before you finish the dish. In other words, you drain it, get as much water off as you can for about an hour, and put it into planks or cubes, saute in a couple tablespoons of oil, drain the oil off, and then proceed with the rest of the dish. So that is another hallmark of the book, in that that's one of the primary ways in which I start off the dishes.
Oh, okay. So there's some consistency to this in a number of different recipes, because it's nice when you can start to apply some of these skills and find yourself making dish after dish and using some similar techniques.
Right, exactly. And the nice thing about tofu is, even though you might prepare it the same way for a lot of different dishes, it always takes on the flavor of the sauce it's in. And so even though it's still pan-fried for like 35, 40 dishes, you have 35, 40 different flavors that will actually appear when the dish is finished. So there's no overlap or there's no redundancy in the flavors from dish to dish, which is, again, sort of a nice thing.
Mmm. Wow. Now, tell me, how many recipes have we got in this wonderful, the Tao of Tofu, your beautiful cookbook here?
I believe there are 110.
Ah. Now, is that of main courses, or does that include the soups and all of the different things that go along with it?
That includes from the appetizers all the way through the sushi and the curries and the baked tofu. I think it's 110 total.
Ah, okay. Ah. Now, when we had our first conversation, there was some mention made about forms of the soy that are, cultured? Can you go into that a little bit?
Like tempeh.
Yeah, or
right.
Miso, or...
Yeah, well, oh yeah, exactly. Miso. Well, I actually have a three-page miso soup discourse in the book. Miso is essentially ground soybeans, and they're cultured with a particular bacillus and let ferment for X amount of time. And they often have wheat added to them, barley, things like that, which gives them a different flavor, different color. Lighter miso is appropriate for summer consumption because it has a lighter flavor and it suits heat very well. Then you have red miso, which is appropriate for winter consumption because it's heavier, saltier, and you need more substantial food in Oriental thinking in the wintertime. And there are some various ones in between. Those are the two main kinds that I talk about in the book. Miso is one of the medicinal foods of the Japanese pantry. There was even some discussion after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. A lot of the radiation victims were given miso soup, and that helped them actually regain some of their health.
Wow.
It's great for your digestion. It has a lot of live bacteria, much like yogurt does. And so miso is a very pro-digestive food. I eat a lot of it. I love it. Love the flavor and the fact that it's very good for me internally. It doesn't hurt either. Miso soup, of course, you get in every Japanese restaurant. Whenever you get sushi, you always get a little bowl of miso soup beforehand. It's a wonderful food. Tempeh is an Indonesian food, and it is beans with a different bacteria on them. And what happens is they make this sort of cake from the ground beans, and they inoculate it with the spores, and it forms sort of a white covering around the tempeh. And that, of course, gives it a nutrient value, gives it a probiotic value as well. I don't have any tempeh in the book because it's entirely different than tofu, and it's a sort of a specialty food, which I don't really cook a lot with. I'm not a real fan of it personally, but that's what it is.
Oh, okay. Okay. So, who knows? I'm just, since you didn't put it in this book, it makes me wonder, do you plan on doing any more cookbooks?
I would love to do volume two. I've got, this is just the beginning. There is so much you can do health-wise with Asian cuisine that a lot of us don't really know about, and I would love to get that out to everybody. There's so many delicious things, and they're so healthy, and they use so many fresh ingredients. I think it's just, it's a perfect kind of cuisine to be introduced to and to integrate into your cooking style, your eating style, because it's economical, it's very good for you, as long as you watch the sodium content, the fat content. For me, it's also a lot of fun to go explore new cuisines. It's one of my big pleasures in life is to cook a new dish, you know, make something new and experience a new flavor, a combination of flavors. It's just one of my big things.
Ah. Now, this is a bit of a, to me, an off-the-wall question that comes back to miso, because at least some of the miso that I've tried has a salty flavor to it.
Correct. It's very salty. They use salt, of course, to preserve the food while it's being fermented. The yellow or light miso has a lighter sodium content. The red has a heavier one, so you don't want to eat a lot of it. You can get away with, in a bowl of miso soup, about a teaspoon or less of actual miso paste. And so you're not getting a whole cup of miso at one time. I wouldn't recommend that to anybody. It's too much salt. So with Asian cuisine, you've got to be quite careful because some of the sauces are quite salty. Soy sauce is very salty. And miso, et cetera, have a fairly significant sodium content, but you don't use very much of it.
Ah.
So I'm sort of mortified when I see people dousing their rice with soy sauce in the restaurant. First off, it's insulting to the chef. Secondly, it's not the way you're supposed to eat your rice. And third, they're just ingesting a ton of sodium. So you've got to be mindful of what you're putting into your food and then what you put into your body.
Ah, so what, some of these Japanese restaurants where the chef is there cooking and you're right at the table and they have a lot of knives. So this...
As you're going with this, and you're absolutely right. And with sushi, too, you've got to be quite mindful of your manners. If you're in Japan, there are so many ways to insult a sushi chef. It's amazing. And sadly, in America, a lot of people tend to practice most of those ways nonchalantly without any sort of thought about the guy behind the counter who's made your sushi. It's taken him years to develop the talent that he has to roll those things. You know, you see people rubbing their chopsticks together, which is insulting to the restaurant owner because you're saying that you have cheap chopsticks in the restaurant. When you see people taking the whole mound of wasabi and putting it into their small bowl of soy sauce and sort of pounding it in there with their finger and then slathering their sushi with it, you're telling the sushi chef that the flavor of your sushi is not good. I have to put this fiery hot wasabi and the salty soy sauce on it to eat it. Yeah, it's absolutely true. There's a whole sort of code of ethics for when you eat in a sushi restaurant that most people in America absolutely don't know a thing about.
Huh. Yeah, well, this is fascinating to me. I mean, because typically when I've been around some of this, there was some wasabi and some pickled ginger that was served along with some of the sushi.
Correct. Now, you know, the pickled ginger, you don't put it on your sushi and eat it. That is intended to cleanse your palate between different kinds of sushi. Usually, if you have fish at least, it goes from lightly fat to heavy fat. Vegetarian sushi, and there's some of that in the book, doesn't quite qualify in that area, but I would still, between different kinds, like avocado or like a spicy tofu or something like that, use a little pickled ginger, it's called gari, to cleanse the palate so you can really fully enjoy the flavors of the sushi. You know, the other thing is don't douse your sushi with soy sauce. It's intended to dip just the corner and then be consumed all at once. You don't want to ruin the flavor of the rice. The rice is the hardest thing to prepare when you make sushi. And in fact, the Japanese say, I'd rather have bad fish than bad rice. So you don't want to ruin the flavor of the rice. It's flavored with a special sushi vinegar, sometimes with a seaweed called kombu. And so you don't want to miss that sort of light, airy flavor of the sea in the rice that you get with sushi.
Okay. So it's a matter of, just from a standpoint of dining, to take time to pause to experiment and experience the flavor a little bit more.
Absolutely. You know, they're very subtle. The Japanese flavors especially don't reach out and grab you very often. Unless, of course, it's wasabi, which can grab you pretty bad, especially if you eat it by mistake, you know, without knowing what it is. But, yeah, there's a very subtle, you should take it very slow and really appreciate the flavors and taste them, you know, and as you're eating your whatever you're eating, it doesn't matter what cuisine it is. But really, you know, think about what you're tasting in there, and you'll enjoy your food so much more.
Yeah. Well, I know one of the favorite things at parties is to bring out a bowl of wasabi and ask people if they like guacamole. And
that's a mean trick, Ken.
Oh, and then, my gosh, the expressions on their faces when they dip that chip in and take a big bite. But it's one of the fastest ways I know to clear sinuses.
Oh, you know, I have had it twice by mistake, thinking it was a piece of avocado. And I thought I was almost going to hallucinate. You know, just permeate your head with this incredible heat. It's like there's a fire in the back of your throat. And you're right, I've got sinus problems, and it's one of my favorite cures is to have some wasabi on something. never intentionally eating a knob of it, of course. But,
no.
it's very therapeutic stuff.
yes. It's great. So if someone were using it with their meal, how would, you know, and operating from this place of grace and respect for the Japanese ways, how would they use that?
You just take a sliver, a small dab, you know, with your chopstick and put it on the corner of your sushi. Dip the other corner perhaps in your soy sauce and eat it that way. In Japan, often the sushi comes with wasabi already in it. They'll take the finger and just put a little stripe of it down the rice after they put the rice on the seaweed and roll it up that way. They don't do that here in America very often. So just the littlest bit, you don't want to, it's like when you have chili peppers. If all you can taste is the chilies, you miss the flavor of everything else.
Yeah.
If all you taste is the wasabi, you might as well be eating plain rice. I mean, who cares what you're eating if that's all you taste, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is important.
Yeah.
So someone that is used to, I guess, hot, spicy food, that's a part of some of the culture in America, the Mexican food. Oh, my gosh, I can eat jalapenos, and I just take a handful and eat them, that kind of thing. It's almost like a machismo or a macho statement of how many or how hot someone can eat something.
Absolutely right.
But what you're saying is that by the time someone's done that, the taste buds are so saturated with the heat of the pepper that all these other flavors aren't even noticeable.
And your nose as well, because your nose is at least half of how you taste food. If you have that wasabi vapor, you know, coming out of your nostrils, you're not going to taste the thing you're eating, right?
Yeah.
and you know, it's a microcosm of a macrocosm. A little wasabi, a little bit of soy sauce, it balances the flavors out. So it's a very small balance in your hand, which is also part of a very large balance, which I ascribe to in cuisine.
Ah, okay. Now something, and I want to kind of get your opinion. One, just sometimes I'm snacking, and I'll take almonds or something, and I love to soak them, and then we'll sometimes take some miso and just scrape a little bit of miso onto an almond because these aren't salted, and salted almonds tend to taste better.
Mm-hmm.
But rather than doing that, I've just used miso as a little bit of a very light dip on them.
I think that's a good idea. I think that you're going to get less salt with a little dab of miso than you would with them being salted, you know, from the store.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the other nutrient value.
Precisely.
That's along with it. Now, you know, and here's something that is probably not in your book, but I'm just kind of thinking along the lines. Can people use a certain amount of miso in some of their other cooking as a way to bring in a salty flavor, but have some wonderful nutrition along with it?
In fact, it's a great salt substitute when you're cooking. I use miso in gravies that I cook that aren't oriental at all, like a brown gravy, things like that. Pardon me. It's a great way to substitute for salt. And, you know, I think that if you do a little bit of research, you can probably find an exact ratio to use, like a quarter teaspoon of miso to half a teaspoon of salt or something like that. And plus, as you mentioned, you're getting all those probiotic qualities as well.
Mm. Okay, wow. So that is quite versatile, and I'm just looking at these different ones in here: miso and wakame soup, and miso and new potato soup, and miso and foo soup. Now, of course, now that's not making fun of someone like from the black culture, is it?
Absolutely not. Foo is a little wheat gluten crouton that is very popular in Japan. You can find them at the Japanese market. They come in various shapes. They haven't got a lot of flavor. You'll find them like little mushrooms or little things like that, and you float them on the top of your soup. They'll rehydrate up there and take in the flavor of the soup, and then you eat them as you're eating your miso.
Ah.
They're fun. It's fun for the kids and things like that, and it's a very, very traditional Japanese. It's almost like a condiment for miso soup, and it just makes it sort of interesting.
Mm, okay. Wow. Well, this is great. And then here for people that have been to Thai restaurants, you have a tofu coconut soup.
Mm, that's one of my favorites. Coconut soups, traditionally, you always simmer them with a little bit of something to give the coconut milk a less sweetness. In this one, there's chilies in here, lime juice. Lime leaves are very important for this dish. They give a real distinct and unattainable aroma and flavor to the soup. You can't substitute anything for them. And again, this is one of my favorites. It's very sublime. You know, the coconut is very smooth on the tongue, but it's very rich at the same time. So this is, again, one of my favorite soups.
Ah, wow. So as we're getting started here now, I guess there's a variety of different recipes. We've got the whole meal prepared, basically from appetizers to salads and soups and main course and desserts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how about different countries? Are we going to go on a little bit of an adventure tour with this cookbook of yours?
Oh, you can. I've got dishes from Thailand, Japan, China, Vietnam, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore in here as well. Dishes from all over the place, and they all have different cooking styles and different sort of signature ingredients that they use. And so you will never be bored at all, I don't think, with this book. Everything is different. Even the dishes that are sort of similar are still quite different when you prepare them. There's a couple of different Szechuan tofu recipes, a couple of Indonesian fried tofu recipes, but they're very different, you know, and they're both authentic. You will sometimes find 10 people cooking the same thing 10 different ways in a country, and it's all authentic. So there's a great deal of leeway between the dishes, although they're called the same thing here in America, and you will still get a nice sort of a panorama of flavors out of them.
Huh.
I've also got, I'm sorry, from
Go
Korea
ahead.
As well, and there's Korean, some Korean dishes as well.
Hmm. Okay. Now, what is my limited awareness of Korean is it goes as far as kimchi.
Right. Kimchi is in a couple of the dishes. There are kimchi pancakes. Pancakes, surprisingly, are really popular in Korea. There is an infinite variety of things they use in these pancakes. And there is a real neat festival once a year where they will offer a pancake up to the patriarch of the family's relatives who are no longer alive. I don't know the name of the festival, but it's really neat. They all sort of have it in their house and have an offering of pancakes. There's a tofu and kimchi soup in here as well. If you've got kind of a spicy pellet. It's got a bit of a kick to it, but it's very good. Bibimbap makes an appearance. That is various blanched vegetables and fried tofu over a mound of rice with optionally a fried egg on top and some hot sauce. And you mix all this together in this sort of mess, but it's absolutely delicious. It's probably some seaweed in there, too. It's wonderful. It's this big mass of food in your bowl. And you've got, you know, everything kind of going all over the place, and you just eat it. It's a wonderful dish.
Now this is in your book?
Yeah, bibimbap is what it's called. A very, very popular mainstay of Korean cuisine. If you've been to any Korean restaurants in town, you've probably seen it on the menu. It has several different spellings. If you were looking in the book, it's on page 96.
Okay.
And it's one of those two-page recipes. There's a lot of preparation for it. But it's one of those things where you just spend the afternoon getting ready for it. Maybe you have some friends come over and help you out, and then you put all this stuff together, and you get this wonderful dish out of it.
Ah. Now something that's and I don't even know, forgive me, I haven't gone through the book as much as I'd like to. Is there any easy way, or how would you suggest if someone wants to prioritize things, because some of these are things that a person could really take some time and have a wonderful, pleasurable experience preparing, and others, when we're in a bit of a time crunch, is there any simple way, or how would you suggest to be able to kind of sort through some of the quickies versus some of the others?
I think when you're sort of thumbing through the book, look for the recipe that is about half a page or three quarters of a page long. Those are the easy ones. You've got like 5, 6, 7 ingredients and maybe 3 or 4 steps, and you're done. Of course, I've included some of the more elaborate ones because they're quite delicious. But actually, if you like to cook, they're a lot of fun to make, and they're very authentic. So, yeah, most of these, I think you can have them ready in about half an hour, 20 minutes.
Mm.
Yeah, nothing is real, as far as the one-pagers go, nothing is really involved. They're all quite easy.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. After you press the tofu, of course, because that takes about an hour. But once you get rolling, you saute it, maybe takes 10 minutes. The sauce might take 10 or 15, throw the tofu back in, heat it up, get the sauce reduced, and serve it.
Now, the pressing of the tofu, is that something that can be done in advance?
Absolutely. You know, you can even do it the day before or the night of whatever. How you do it is you want to get extra firm tofu because that has the best and firmest texture, the most tooth to it. And I'll usually cut it in half, and I'll get 2 pie pans or 2 loaf pans that fit into each other. Put the pie pan on the counter, both halves of the tofu in the pie pan. The second pie pan on top of the tofu, so it makes sort of a hydraulic press. And then something heavy on top of that pie pan, like a big can of juice or a brick, or I've used a 5-pound bag of rice from India before, whatever you have on hand that's
ah.
And let it go for about an hour.
Put the children on there.
Put the kid on there, as long as they don't move too much.
Okay.
You won't believe how much water comes out of that tofu. You'll get at least a cup and a half of water out of that thing. You drain the water off.
Wow.
Then you proceed to cut it up and saute it, and you've got this whole brand new, if you've never done it that way before, brand new food. You know, it's so far removed from the soft, pre-processed stuff you get in the restaurant or the deep-fried stuff you get there, which to me is as bad or worse. I mean, they don't have a vegetarian fryer in most restaurants. And so you're getting the tofu that's been fried in the same oil that the pork egg rolls have been, that the shrimp has been in, that the whatever. And if you're like me and have sort of a hyper-refined palate, you can often taste that stuff in the tofu when you get it from the deep fryer oil.
Oh.
And if you're also a conscientious vegetarian, that may not be something you want to ingest when you're having your dinner.
Yeah. Okay. And any recommendations on oils?
I use 3 primarily, canola, safflower, and sunflower. They're light oils. They have high smoking points, which is important because you want to saute the tofu at about a medium-high heat. That way it'll get a nice brown patina on the outside. It'll help get a little more of the water out of the inside and firm up the inside as well. I don't recommend, of course, olive oil. It's not Asian in the least bit. It has a low smoking point, especially if you use extra virgin, and you shouldn't even cook with extra virgin at all. It's not a cooking oil. But even regular olive oil that you cook with will flavor the tofu. You know, that's why you use it. It gives a nice olive oil flavor to the food, and it's wonderful in the appropriate cuisine. But for Asian food, it's an absolute no-no.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I wanted to have you bring up, because you've done some research, that some of the people are saying, oh, my gosh, you can have miso, you can have tempeh, but the regular soy has got some components in it that can be harmful, and so there's a group within the vegetarian community that that has some very strong opinions about that, and I know you have some insight to share.
I do. You know, as with most things, some of it's good and too much of it's bad. Moderation in all things, I think, is the starting point right here. There have been some studies done by some somewhat shady organizations, a couple of them at least, that have put a bad light on tofu.
You mean there's a tofu mafia?
There's a tofu mafia. Honestly, there is an organization, and I don't remember the name offhand, but they are part of essentially the Beef Council. So you know they're not going to do a favorable study on tofu. There was one done in Hawaii, and it pointed to some brain atrophy and things like that. None of this has been repeated. None of it is... When you do a study, you want to study more than 35 people, or 37 people. So you want a broad study to really know your results are properly arrived at. What the more, how can I say, middle-of-the-road physicians are saying is that tofu in small or medium-sized amounts is great. It does have some good estrogenic effect for women in menopause. It has some good effect as far as your protein. It's very easily digested and assimilated protein for the body. So essentially what the less hysterical physicians are saying is everybody calm down. And just, it's like with eggs, and people freaked out over eggs a few years ago, and now you can eat an egg a day.
Yeah.
You know, so it's sort of the same thing. Just don't go and eat a pound and a half of tofu every night. I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't want anybody else to do that. You know, your protein shouldn't be the main focus of your meal anyway. It should be fruits and vegetables, some grain, and then your protein.
Ah.
So that's why, you know, the serving sizes in the book are going to be fairly small, because you don't want to have, you know, a platter of tofu swimming in sauce and eat the whole thing. It's not what you should do. So, again, moderate your intake. Small portions of protein are good no matter what you're eating. And I don't think anybody's going to notice any effect from the tofu as long as you consume it that way.
Okay. And that, from your studies, that's the way tofu is used in these different countries? It's not
absolutely.
Like the, not like a main course, like throwing down a big slab of ribs?
No, you know, no. Most Asian countries don't have what we would consider a main course at all. In the back of the book, there is a section on eating and serving styles in various Asian countries. And you have a panoply of dishes. You have, you know, some soup. You have rice, typically, or noodles. Then you have, like, a protein and maybe three or four different vegetable dishes and maybe some pickles on the table or some sauces, things like that. So, really, it's much more balanced than what we get here in America. The reason I split the book up in appetizers, soups, and then main dishes was to sort of westernize the way that the book could be read by us here in America, so it made more sense to people. You don't want to just have, like, you know, page 1 to page 184, just recipes. I wanted to give people sort of an idea of what they're sort of intended for, but, again, to serve them in the proper way, in the proper Asian way.
Wow! So we're gonna dine and have delicious flavors, and also learn about some of this way to modify our eating habits for better health.
I would hope so. I think that we need to, of course, eat less protein overall, and eat a lot more fruit and vegetable dishes and the good grains as well.
Yeah. Now, there was a nutritionist in Denver many years ago, Gordon Tetzler, And one of the things that he had made mention, and I don't know if you'd ever heard this, he said, when is the time in our life where we're growing the fastest? And so, well, when we're newborn, and just a newborn baby just grows and grows and grows. And he says, yeah, well, that's when we're building the body, and we think we would have the most demand for protein. And then he went on to say, what's the most perfect food for a baby? Well, mother's milk. And I'm sorry about the Carnation Company and pet milk. I didn't mean to insult them there. But anyway, we're going with mother's milk for today in our show until it's proven otherwise not to be good for babies. Then he said, well, mother's milk has about 2% protein. And I went, huh? That was like, wow, fall off your chair.
Yeah, well, we don't need very much.
So this is just fascinating. Now, from this book, and of course people want to be able to go to, once again, Chef Robert Church, Chef Robert Church, all the normal ways you'd think that stuff would be spelled, chefrobertchurch.com, and they can pick up, either order the book in hard copy or get the e-book from you, right?
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
Okay, and I don't know if you have, but I was just having this kind of a moment of hallucination. That's probably because I'm so hungry from not having food while talking to you about all this food.
Not fair, is it?
No, it is. And one of the things that I didn't know, if you have any plans for evolving your website or future books, to be including some photos or stories of people that are moving into this lifestyle and some of their wonderful experiences around following some of your advice in these recipes.
I would love to hear from anybody that visits my website. Every person I talked to at the convention, I made sure, well, my web address, of course, is in the book. I gave them a card, and I said, if and when you cook these dishes, you let me know. You email me and tell me what you think about them. And I tell everybody that I meet that has the book or that even wants to explore this kind of cuisine, I want to know what you think about it. I would love to hear people's stories. I'd love to get feedback and just associate with people that are in the same sort of culinary mindset that I am. Absolutely. Anybody that emails me, it's a delight to hear from people. Absolutely. Love to.
And your email address is?
It's on the website, but it's rchurch@chefrobertchurch.com.
Okay. Good. Oh, this is wonderful. And so just some of your goals, how do you think people are going to benefit from getting your book?
Well, first off, if you are looking at cutting back on your animal proteins, what a great way to do it with tofu. And with a great sort of a spectrum of recipes to start off with, I want people to read the book. I wrote a lot beside the recipes in there. I gave little headers about the dishes, about every dish, little tidbits of information. And I want people to read and learn about Asian cultures and about how other people eat and other cooking techniques and things like that. And that really would be my primary hope for this book, is people learn from it, benefit from it health-wise, benefit from it in a culinary sense. I love food. Ken, I'm a foodie. I've been a foodie since I was like 3 years old. I'm not kidding. And
a foodie means?
A foodie means someone that loves food and all kinds of different food, and I like to explore different kinds of food and taste new things all the time. You know, I buy cookbooks just to read them. I'm not kidding. It's crazy. But I've got a shelf full of stuff that I probably will never cook with, but it's a great read. So I want people to try new things, and I want people to expand their culinary palates. And mostly I want them to try tofu.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, for all these benefits. Plus, with getting your book, it sounds like we'd not only have wonderful food at our tables, but we'd have an opportunity to chat. And from parts of your book, we could converse about what we're eating and some of the cultural things. So it's topics for conversation as well as palate-pleasing meals.
Absolutely. It's much more than just, to me, of course, I wrote this thing, but it's much more than just a cookbook. It's sort of an entree into who I am, and it's an entree into other people's lives that I don't know, if you know what I mean. People buy this that I don't know. They read it. Suddenly we have something in common, and that's really neat. And that can expand infinite amounts of distance. So it's, I suppose, from my perspective, a much bigger thing than just a cookbook.
Wow. Wow, yeah, obviously. Well, I can't wait to dive in and try some recipes. And Robert, I want to thank you for taking time from your busy schedule to be with myself and our wonderful listeners here today.
Ken, thank you, and thank everybody that's been listening. This has been a great pleasure. It was a pleasure to meet you, and certainly hope to see you again.
Oh, we can count on that. I've got to get some dinner parties going, and I know you come and help with those, don't you?
I absolutely do. It's another thing I really, really enjoy doing. It's always a good time.
Ah, wonderful. Well, thank you. You have a great week, and to all my beloved listeners out there, God bless you, and may you go have fun with a Tao of Tofu. Tune in next Saturday for more fun and adventures here at Advanced Living Radio. Until then, God bless and goodbye for now. Let go.